Pain was a necessary part of his growth. Without it, he would not have been the Johnny Cash we know. He took comfort from the Apostle Paul's story of the unspecified thorn in the flesh. Paul pleaded 3 times for this suffering to end, but said that God told him, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness." 2 Corinthians 12:9. In other words, the weakness produced by the pain was necessary in order for God to reveal his power and forgiveness. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. 1 Corinthians 12:10. Cash seemed to understand this. The times of his greatest suffering were paradoxically the times of his greatest spiritual strength. When on top of the world, he tended to trust in his own invincibility. He said himself that during the 1960s, he thought he was indestructible, that he could do anything he wanted to his body without any adverse consequences. It was only as his frailties emerged that he developed humility, caution, and concern. In his final years, as Cash was gradually stripped of everything, his sight, his mobility, his strength, his looks, and finally his wife, he became more confident than ever in the object of his faith. "I think that after June died, he was different," says Kelly Hancock. "He became even more compassionate towards people. He was kinder. He was more thoughtful. He worried about people. He took everyone in a bit closer, and he treasured everyone." He particularly loved being with his grandchildren, who brought out his playfulness and made him laugh again. Laura Cash recalls, "Most days we would bring our daughter, Anna Maybell, with us. She would come in the front door and head like a bullet for Grandpa's room. He took much delight in her company, as he did with all his grandkids. He'd say, 'Hi, sweet baby,' over and over. She would crawl up in his lap, and he would immediately produce some sugar-free chocolate for her. Even in those sad and lonely times, she could really draw the laughter out of him." There were some champagne grapes at the house one day, and John was so patient as Annabelle fed him one after the other for what seemed like an hour. He would brighten up at the mere sight of her and our son, Joseph. He had an electric recliner that, of course, our kids loved to operate. As soon as he sat down, they would be over pushing buttons and have him laid out flat before I knew it. Up and down and up again. I tried to get them to stop, but John wouldn't have it. He was a very loving, patient grandpa. He restored his relationship with Marshall Grant despite the bitterness of their separation. "In the end," says Marshall, "we became closer than we had ever been." According to Kelly, Cash's life became characterized by a spirit of gratefulness. He felt that he had had a blessed life and that he wouldn't trade 1 minute of it, she says. He felt that his struggles he had been through made him a stronger man, had given him a footstool to climb up to God that he might never have had. I never heard him complain. There were days when I could see that he didn't feel good and didn't look good, and yet he'd get up and go do a session, and I would think, how is he doing this? So many times we wondered, how can he go over there to the cabin and stay for 4 or 5 hours when he's barely able to walk across the room? We didn't know. We know now that it was a divine strength that he was given, but it continued to amaze us. His son, John Carter, embraced the same Christian faith and became a close spiritual companion. They spent many hours praying together and discussing the Bible. According to John Carter, he felt that his spiritual strength resulted from all the adversity he had faced. "It's like the strongest sword is made by the hottest fire," he says. He was like Peter to Christ. Peter was a greatly tortured soul who was in misery and pain, but who had something in him that brought him close to Christ. That's how it was with my dad. I think God knew that he would struggle, that he would fall down, but he saw something in him that would be a foundation for a lot of people, just as Christ saw something in Peter. Cash was an unusual figure in American popular music, a Christian with traditional evangelical beliefs, who was revered by icons of the subculture as well as figureheads of mainstream culture. Few Christians would find themselves the subject of accolades by such diverse personalities as Snoop Dogg and George W. Bush, Nick Cave and Billy Graham, Trent Reznor and Dolly Parton. Cash's acceptance didn't come from keeping his light hidden under a bushel. He was as explicit about his beliefs in personal conversation as he was in his songs, but he never appeared sanctimonious and he resisted relying on cliché. When he spoke about God, he gained respect because he spoke from his heart. He wasn't merely reciting a creed. And the God of Johnny Cash, the God that shone through Johnny Cash, seemed interesting and relevant. Rick Rubin tells a story of inviting Cash to a meal at his home, along with some musicians and friends from the film industry. Before eating, Cash asked everyone to hold hands while he prayed and then read from the Bible. "I know that some of these people had never experienced that before," said Rubin. "Some of them were even atheists. But his belief in what he believed was so strong that what you believe didn't matter so much. It was really beautiful." Everyone who worked with Cash knew of his beliefs because he spoke of God in such a natural way, without proselytizing. He preferred to wait for others to open up to him. "I don't compromise my religion," he said in 1979. "If I'm with someone who doesn't want to talk about it, I don't talk about it. I don't impose myself on anybody in any way, including religion." His friends agree. "He was a deeply religious man," says David Ferguson, "but he didn't drive it down anybody's throat." Surprisingly, Chris Christopherson says that the two of them never discussed religion. "I think John respected people enough to let them do their own deciding about what they do spiritually," he says. "He got me along to a couple of Billy Graham events, and that was enough. I think he was sensitive to the fact that I didn't want to talk about it." To those who wanted to talk about spiritual matters, he was more than willing to share his thoughts. He and Rick Rubin engaged in deep debates about meditation, mysticism, Jesus, and Eastern thought. "I think that the depth of our connection was always about spirit, and we used music as a vocabulary for that," he says. "It was always about otherworldly things, beyond worldly things." In April 2003, they took communion together for the first time and continued the ritual over the phone every time they spoke over the next 5 months. Producer Larry Butler was so affected by Cash's faith when he worked with him in Israel on the Gospel Road film that he was baptized in the Jordan River and remains a committed Christian more than 30 years later. Diane Rivkin, who produced and wrote the TV special Riding the Rails for him in 1974, was another person affected by his faith. "I saw something very special in him as we were doing the show," she says. "I asked him what it was, and he said simply, 'Jesus Christ.' He bought her a Bible and spent hours answering her questions. She became a Christian as a direct result of his interest and patience, and 14 years later, Rivkin produced him as he recorded the entire New Testament for a cassette collection. Almost a quarter of the songs he wrote were in some way about his faith or the Bible. Many others, although not specifically about faith, were influenced by his Christian worldview. 'I Walk the Line,' with its declaration of marital fidelity, contained an unconscious Christian impulse, as did a lot of his songs about justice and poverty. When he wrote about work, he did so from a biblical framework. Work could be a source of dignity and pride, but in a fallen world, work could also be degrading and exploitative. He accentuated the nobility of labor, but never failed to point out how backbreaking it could sometimes be. In doing so, he celebrated the lives of ordinary hard-working people, from shoeshine boys to police officers, stonecutters to truck drivers, and made them feel that they were important. He wrote about death, but not as a morbid subject. When people died in his songs, it was usually the result of an injustice or a love affair gone wrong. His best-known murder line, "I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die," appears in a song about imprisonment, freedom, and longing. Murder isn't the focus of the song. Most often, his death songs were actually about salvation. He was looking beyond death to the life to come.